I remember once going to the Adler Planetarium in Chicago as a kid and joining the audience in a group exclamation of wonder when the stars and planets were projected before our eyes. The sight was amazing to us because we all lived in urban areas where outdoor lighting obscured the night sky. Few of us had ever seen, personally, the sheer number of stars that we saw above us in the planetarium, a sight that was once visible nearly everywhere in the world on any clear night for free. But even with modern-day light pollution, the heavens still provide us with plenty to see, and our guest on Focus today is ready to tell us how to find those sights. University of Illinois astronomer James Kaler says not even city lights can keep you from following the brightest stars and planets, plus the moon and the nearest star, the sun. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus has a look at the bright sky after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. There are lots of books about viewing the night sky, but light pollution makes less of the night sky visible to us. Our guest today wants us to enjoy as much night sky as possible, even if it's not as much as our maybe great-grandparents could see. James B. Kaler is Professor Emeritus of Astronomy at the University of Illinois. He's published several books on astronomy for the layman, and he has a new book out called First Magnitude, a book of the bright sky from World Scientific Publishing, and we'll be talking about what you can still see and enjoy in the night sky, even if you live where the streetlights are bright and numerous. Professor Kaler, welcome back. And I should say welcome back to Focus.
Thank you.
You've been on this program many times.
Yeah, it goes way, way back.
Well, it's glad to have you on the program again. I was wondering, after a career of astronomical study, and I gather that some of your research is pretty technical and may not have actually involved literally looking at your eyes with your eyes at the stars, can you still enjoy simple stargazing?
Is it still fun for you? Oh, sure. I'll go out in the backyard, even with binoculars, and look around. It's just fun. I see lots of old friends because I grew up with a dark nighttime sky and learned by sky back as a teenager, and it's still with me.
And before I go on to another question, I do want to remind people that we welcome you to the conversation as well if you have a question or a stargazing experience that you'd like to share. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. What is it that we're missing in the sky due to light pollution?
Lots and lots of stars. you go out in even around here, and you'll see basically what are called first magnitude stars and a few other fainter ones, depending upon where you live. But you don't see the absolute spangled sky that you would see in a dark location, which is really remarkably awesome. There was a story, probably apocryphal, but there was some truth behind it, but in the lights went out in Los Angeles and the stars showed up. People got scared and called the police. They didn't know what all these little lights were. They'd heard of stars, but had never seen them before. But you can see some of the brighter ones. And the object of this book is to get people outdoors, even in light polluted areas, to look up and see what you can see. And starting with the sun. Now, don't look at the sun. Please don't look at the sun. You read descriptions of it. It's a dangerous thing to look at.
But it is a star.
It is a star. It's ours, and it makes for daylight, and is a fascinating body, both in its benign forms and in its magnetic forms, where it can explode matter off the surface, produce the aurorae, and the northern lights, southern lights, do all kinds of interesting stuff.
And
the moon, it's hard to miss the moon. I don't care where you live. You could live in downtown Chicago, and you're going to see the moon.
Let me go back to the sun, because people think, well, there's the sun. We can't miss it. It comes up in the east, and it goes down into the west. And we can't look at it directly without a lot of help. So what can we do? What can you recommend for an enhanced viewing experience with the sun.
Go on the web and take a look at some of the pictures there. It's a dangerous thing to look at, and you should never try to make your own filters because amateur filters can leak radiation in different wavelength bands that you can't see, and you could still damage the eye. Do not look at the sun directly unless you have a professionally made filter. And even then, you won't see too much. There are telescopes that are made for looking at the sun, but they tend to be pretty expensive. The best way is to find an open house during the day with somebody with a proper appropriate filter, and we don't have anything like that around here. So if you get on the web, however, you can look at the SOHO site, the stereo site, you can see some gorgeous images of the sun taken in various wavelength bands, from the X-ray, ultraviolet, showing solar explosions. It's really quite a dramatic sight.
I gather from your book that although the sun does rise in the east and go down in the west, going by the Earth's orbit, it doesn't go rise and fall in quite the same spot.
No, I go to work around the time of sunrise, and I've been watching it make its progression from the southeast to, into the northeast. Now, that's a result of the tilt of the Earth's axis compared to the orbital axis. As we go around, the sun appears to move to the north and to the south and back to the north. This is what causes our seasons.
And is that something you can tell, you know, for on a day-to-day basis?
Well, that's I think, perhaps one of the great fascinations of, quote, watching the sun rather than looking at the physical aspects of it. You can see the Earth's orbital aspects of it and how it, in summertime, you get long periods of daylight, how in wintertime you get short periods of daylight and long nights. And all of this is explained in the book. And it's fun to watch over the course of the year. When I was teaching undergraduates, I used to have them look at locate the position of sunset or sunrise if they got up early enough, but few students do. And they were almost incredulous. It moves. It goes from the southwest to the northwest. It's something our ancestors took for granted and understood very well. If you're a farmer out in the fields, you're gonna see this, and even back to ancient times, but we've sort of lost sight of it with the buildings and with the we just don't pay too much attention to it anymore.
One thing I gathered from reading your book is that the most satisfying stargazing, it's sort of like a long-term relationship. It's not just going out one night two or three times a year.
The analogy, I guess, is if rather primitive analogy, is you don't go bowling the first time and roll a 300 game. It takes practice and it takes a little work. You go out and you look for your very brightest stars, and you begin to use some of those as guideposts and find the fainter ones and the fainter constellations and work your way around the sky. That's once you found a few things like that, then you can get a small telescope and look at the moon, look at the various planets. The planets all have significant characteristics that make them all different from each other. They're very recognizable from the stars. They tend to be much brighter, notably brighter than the stars. The only one that isn't is Saturn, of the ancient standard planets. Venus is brilliant. You can't miss it when it's at its best. Jupiter is beautifully up in the sky now. You'll get a clear sky and look to the west, and you'll see Jupiter. You don't need a map to find it. Just look for the brightest thing you can see.
And
it's north of the first magnitude star called Aldebaran, and it's a reddish star, so you can see some begin to see some color contrasts. And Aldebaran is in front of a cluster called the Hyades. Well, you can begin to admire that, especially if you've got some binoculars and you turn it out of the area. Not too far away is a little cluster called the Pleiades, and even these are visible in a reasonably out in the suburbs a little bit.
You mentioned binoculars, and that's a question is you don't. You can get an enhanced experience. You don't need an astronomical telescope.
You can see Jupiter's moons in binoculars.
Wow.
It's a little bit difficult. You have to hold them very steadily, hold them on a car roof or something, and just so it doesn't shake. You can see these little spots coming out from the side of Jupiter, even with 7 power binoculars, and begin to see the so-called Galilean satellites.
In the naked eye, as we see it through the atmosphere, if I understand from your book, stars twinkle. Planets do not.
Planets twinkle a lot less than stars because stars are points. From our perspective, they might as well be perfect points. But planets actually have little disks. If you look at them with a telescope, they you can see surface features on them, and that tends to reduce the twinkling notably. You won't see Jupiter jump around. Where you see Aldebaran next to it twinkle back and forth a little bit. It's an atmospheric effect.
So if
it's a pretty thing in a way, but to a professional astronomer, it's an awful sight when you're looking at it through a telescope.
So if we go out, say tonight or a night this weekend, granting a clear sky, and look for the planets, I think you mentioned Jupiter.
There's only
the
two of them that are up right now. Okay. Jupiter is to the west, and if you wait till a little bit later in the evening, 10 or 11 o'clock in the evening, you'll see Saturn rising up over in the southeast. Saturn is to the east of a first magnitude star called Spica. So what you'll see is two apparent stars of about the same brightness in the southeast. The left-hand one is Saturn.
Okay, and if you use something like field binoculars, can you make out anything that...
Not on Saturn. If you have a small telescope, even 30, 40 power or something like that, you can begin to see the ring structures around Saturn.
Okay.
If you've got a fairly... You get up to 80, 100 power if you've got a small telescope. It's a beautiful sight.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with University of Illinois astronomer James Kaler about watching the night sky in an age of light pollution. Besides conducting research and writing textbooks, Kaler has written several books on astronomy for the layman, the latest of which is First Magnitude, a book of the bright sky. And if you have questions or comments about stargazing and astronomy, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email your question to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Going back to the night sky, of course, one big object there, Jim, is the moon.
Oh, that's just a lot of fun to watch. You can see it going through its phases, which is moon goes around the Earth, of course, roughly once a month, hence the period of time called the month. And the sky tends to be so illusory. Everything looks to be at the same distance. The moon is close to us. The sun is 400 times farther away. And what you see in the phases is just that you're looking at different portions of the daylit side. Half the moon is in sunlight. The other half is in darkness. And when you're seeing a full moon, you're looking... The moon is opposite the sun, and you see the full illuminated face. At new moon, when the moon is between the Earth and the sun, you're looking at the dark side of the moon, the nighttime side of the moon, and you can't see it. It's gone from the sky, which is great for stellar astronomers because it doesn't light up the sky, and you can see the stars. In a light-polluted area, it doesn't really make all that much difference. But you may notice at full moon, you can see a lot less than you can at the other phases. When the moon's at right angles to the sun, you'll see it in its quarters. And it's fun to watch the moon go through its phases. You can watch the moon go move against the background of the stars over the course of a single night. Moon moves its own angular diameter of half a degree in about an hour. So if you look at it in the early evening relative to a nearby star, you don't even have to know that the star is, and look at it later in the evening, you'll actually have watched, you can see the moon moving in orbit.
With my experiment in stargazing last night, where I went down to a country road, but still lots of light pollution, I think I was close to both.
It's getting worse and worse.
I was close to both I-57 and Mohammed, I believe.
Bad idea.
Looked at the moon, low in the sky. This is probably about 9 o'clock. Low in the sky and a little reddish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that same thing as reddish sunsets. That's caused by the Earth's atmosphere. The air tends to, that's why we got a blue sky. The air picks out the blue component of sunlight, gives you a blue sky, and it tends to make the sun and the moon a little bit more red than they would have seen from space. And when you see the moon rising, you're looking at the horizon at almost 40, looking through almost 40 times as much air as when you look overhead. And the moon will then appear to be rising quite reddish, depending upon the moisture content of the air and a variety of other things. And you notice that as you watch the moon rise, you look through less and less air, and the moon changes color from reddish to white.
And I did notice, I looked at the moon again from my apartment building about an hour later, and It was somewhat higher in the sky and not red at all.
Yeah, and if you look at the sun at sunset, if it's comfortable to look at the sun at sunset or sunrise, it's not going to do any damage. But you know, if it's uncomfortable, don't do it. But when you watch the sun rise, it's squashed. You got refraction in the air. The lower part of the sun is pushed up more than the upper part of the sun. The sun comes out to be an oval when it rises. It's a curious looking sight, which rapidly disappears as the sun rises. The moon will do the same thing if you see it.
Let's go to a caller. This is Craig in Urbana on line 4. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
I have about 3 quick comments. One, Professor Kaler is well known on the campus and a hero to a number of students for his popularization of astronomy and the annual lecture he gives us. So we appreciate that. The second thing is the University Club does hold an open house, typically the first Friday of every month, at the Little Observatory south of Folinger, southeast of Folinger Hall on the campus. And this month, or next month, is April, we're going to be doing it on the 12th for Mom's Day from 8 to 10 p.m. If anybody's interested in that, the observatory will be open. And as to the remarks about the solar observing, of course, Professor Kaler is absolutely right about looking at the sun, but the astronomy department does have professional filters for the 12-inch telescope that we do use, and we also have a projection system, and we've done solar viewing each of the Friday, Saturdays on engineering open house weekend, and we're talking about maybe adding some daytime open houses during the year if things work out well. So I just wanted to give you that information.
Thank you.
Okay, Craig, before you go, let me ask you again about that date. That's in 2 weeks, I guess, April 12th?
Yes.
At 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. and that's
8 to 10 is the I just got the email from our club president last night.
And that's the open house which the U of I Astronomical Society holds.
Correct.
At the old observatory, and
correct,
that's the one that's I guess behind Folinger Hall.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
a venerable old instrument. It goes back to the 1890s when it was dark.
Yep.
It was built near the Mara Plots in the dark on the hill. If you look, it's actually a little rise going up there,
mm-hmm,
Observatory Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a national historic landmark.
Right.
It's a very important telescope because electronic astronomy was invented there around 1912.
Exactly. And we do have an organization called Friends of the Observatory, whose function is to restore and preserve both the telescope and the building now, too.
So we're making progress, too, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yep. Yes, we are.
Indeed.
So people could, say, perhaps Google both of these organizations, Friends of the Observatory and the University of Illinois Astronomical Society,
exactly,
to find out more?
In fact, we encourage them to do so.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering, I haven't been to the observatory. I've walked around it. I noticed the street lights right next to it painted black on one side in an effort to reduce the light pollution.
Yeah,
but it's
I believe
got
that was John Dickel's work many years ago. He got the campus to put screens up, the lights that are facing the observatory. But then they built a new building in the old Veer Hall parking lot, and it shines mightily upon the observatory.
Well, what are you still able to see from that observatory with all that light pollution?
Are you asking me?
Sure, Craig.
Yeah. We're able to get good views of Jupiter, good views of Saturn. We can split a number of double stars.
Oh, you can see nebulae clusters.
Sure.
You can see a lot with the telescope because you can point it by setting circles. You don't have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The view of Saturn through that telescope, it's a beautiful telescope. It's a lovely Brashear lens made in the 19th century.
Yep.
And the view of Saturn or Jupiter is just awesome, and the moon. I've seen students look at Saturn for the first time and come out with expletives and say, mm-hmm, oh, that's not real. You painted that on, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, let's remember that date then. Friday, April 12th from 8 to 10 for the next open house at the observatory, the old observatory,
just southeast of Folinger Auditorium.
And that's on the south end of the quad,
right,
on the U of I Urbana campus.
Correct, yes.
Well, Craig, thank you very much for calling us in.
You bet.
Take care.
Bye.
Now, Jim, the university has a newer observatory that you were just telling me about before we went on the air.
I believe the CU Astronomical Society runs or works with a telescope that's south of town, but that they occasionally have open houses down there, but it's not generally open to the public.
Is there research being done with that
facility? Not on the campus, no. We had a 1-meter research telescope down near Oakland, Illinois, near Walnut Point State Park for many years, and that the building is still there, but the telescope has been moved out to San Diego. Where you got 300 clear nights a year up in the Laguna Mountains. And the telescope is still functioning nicely out there. The astronomy department also works with and helps run a large radio telescope out in California.
So when the U of I astronomy department is doing research, it's working with facilities which are not on the campus?
Observation, no. There are no research facilities on the campus unless you want to count massive computing as a research facility. And there the astronomy department really shines on this campus. You notice that Blue Waters just went into operation yesterday. Mm-hmm. The most powerful university computer probably in the world. And we will certainly make use of time on it.
Okay. It is about 10:25 as we do this broadcast live. Your clock may say something different if you're listening to our 8 o'clock rebroadcast. And we're talking with Jim Kaler, U of I astronomer, about watching the night sky in his book First Magnitude, A Book of the Bright Sky. I want to ask you about the phrase about magnitudes, about this way of measuring the brightness of
stars. Oh, this goes
stars.
Back. This is fun. This goes back to about 300 B.C. When an astronomer named Hipparchus in the Greek islands decided to organize the stars a little bit. So he called the brightest ones he could see. It was all very arbitrary back then. First magnitude, and there are about a little over 20 of them. And the second brightest, the second magnitude, and so on. And he divided six categories, and the faintest ones he could see he called six. Why he came up with six, I have no idea. Maybe it was just an easy way of him splitting the stars. It was entirely arbitrary. And we still use the same system, although it's a 2,000-year-old system that now is on a firm mathematical basis. We can measure magnitudes to the thousandth of a unit at this point. As so many things are in astronomy, they tend to go back to very old times. It's the most ancient of sciences.
Well, your book is guaranteeing maybe about 22 stars that you can count on seeing of the first magnitude.
Yeah, and I tossed in the brightest second magnitude Castor because it's next to a first magnitude star called Pollux, and Pollux and Castor, which you can see pretty much overhead in the early evening. Look for sort of twin stars, one of them Pollux is a little bit on the orange side. And it's hard to miss. Just look pretty much overhead early evening. And they are always taken together, so I stuck Castor in as an honorary first magnitude star.
Okay.
If the other astronomers don't like that, that's too bad.
Good for Castor. And let's go to line one and Tom in Springfield. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Hey, so I live in a small community near Springfield, Illinois, and as it develops more and more lights and light pollution, and it's taken away from one of my activities that I really enjoyed was just sitting outside at night.
Yep.
Stars and satellites and everything else. What can be done to not combat a community, but to convince them about the above? What can be done about nightlife?
It takes work, but it can be done. You really have to get an organization of your local astronomy club or university with an astronomy, at least teaching astronomy classes in a telescope, to get involved with the city government. Because nobody's trying to get rid of lights. Lights are important in our society. But there's so much wastage of it. 50% or more of it just goes up into the sky where it scatters off and does no good whatsoever except to waste a lot of money. So you can approach them on the economics of it, for one thing. It's just terribly wasteful what we're doing now. If you need the lights, put it down on the ground where you need it and where it does no harm to the sky. But you really have to get involved with your city council or village council and convince them that it's worth doing. It's been done. Tucson, for example, has powerful, very strong lighting ordinances, largely because the lighting of Tucson affects Kitt Peak National Observatory 50 miles to the southwest. And they've done a wonderful job of it. The sky is not a lot brighter at Kitt Peak than it was when they first began putting up the telescopes in the 60s. They've done pretty much the same thing in the San Diego area for Palomar and for San Diego State. So it can be done, but it does take a lot of effort. We've used to have do a lot of promoting of that around here, but most of the astronomers that did are gone and retired. And if you look around, especially the athletic lights here in the university, they're terrible. They just scatter straight up, and they don't do any good whatsoever. Terrible waste.
It sounds like it possibly is somewhat of an easy fix to stop the light from going up.
All you
up.
Need to do is put a cap on your lights, have the proper reflector shields, and put the light down on the ground, and you make a huge difference, and you also save a lot of money.
Why don't they do it?
Beats me.
There are some kind of standards, like in San Diego and in Tucson, that people have done it that you can present to your local community.
Yeah, we've tried to. We've done. I know Parkland College Starkle Planetarium has done some work through with some of the local lighting ordinances. I'm not up on what's being done politically with it locally.
Okay.
But one thing that can be done is to get interested and get involved with the International Dark Sky Association, which you can find on the web. It's operated out of Tucson.
Well, Tom, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the International Dark Sky Association.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that I remember seeing come up during my days covering the Urbana City Council at one point, where they were looking at plans for new streetlights, and there was an alderman who was, I think, particularly concerned about light pollution, and was trying to point out that the designs exist for streetlights that concentrate their light down and not out. And
if you're interested in this, I'd call Starkle Planetarium. They have more information on it out there locally. I know the city of Urbana got to like these globe lights because they were aesthetically pretty, but they also were terrible waste because they threw lights straight up.
Yeah,
you don't need it straight up.
I did gather that in the city there were some people took the problem more seriously than others.
Yeah, the major problem is not the street lights; it's the gas station lights and the auto dealerships and the Walmarts and everybody who leaves their lights on all night long when it's not necessary.
Well, it's time for a short break. We have a caller waiting, and we'll be back to him as we talk more about urban stargazing with astronomer Jim Kaler. This is Focus on WILL.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Frank Langella. He says he got rid of his native New Jersey accent as a kid, listening to legendary British actor John Gielgud's albums and imitating his voice.
And pretty soon I sounded like, you know, in the middle of Bayonne, New Jersey, here comes this little British lord.
Frank Langella's film Robot and Frank is out on DVD. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programming on WILL is made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation at 5th and John Streets in Champaign, a welcoming and inclusive community living out a progressive approach to faith. McKinley Church's schedule of Holy Week and Easter season services is available online at www.mckinley-church.org.
I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with astronomer Jim Kaler, author of First Magnitude, a book of the bright sky published by World Scientific Publishing. Book is about stargazing in the age of light pollution. You can call us at 333-9455 or toll free at 800-222-9455. And let's get to a caller now. And on line four, we're talking to Ed in Rockford. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate the show, and I have an astronomy student I'm trying to get to listen to this show. We're trying to get her to interested in astronomy, which she has a very keen interest. And I do, too. I always was interested in stars. Out on the farm, we could see so many of them. And then I went to University of Illinois, and I took astronomy as electives. I proficiency exam the two basic courses without just by taking an exam, and Dr. Wyatt gave me the exams, and then we had to, Dr. Swanson, who I believe may still be there in radio astronomy.
Yes, he is. He is. He's still working over in electrical engineering or whatever they call the department now. And
right.
It's nice to hear Stan Wyatt's name brought up. He was a mentor of mine and a dear man.
Yes, and then there was Dr. McVitie.
Oh, yeah. He hired
me. I was there in 1957 when the Soviet Sputnik satellite went up, and we tracked that satellite. And Dr. Swanson was fairly active in radio tracking the satellite with an interferometer set up right there on the campus. And we'd get up cold nights. We'd go up on top of the Animal Science Building and track the satellites with this photography.
Yeah, we used to have a deck up there. We used to bring students out where you could actually see the stars on top of the Animal Sciences Building on the campus. It was... It was great fun. But those days, I'm afraid, are gone forever. The lighting just keeps getting worse and worse.
Yes, and we had a South Observatory there where we would there used to be a 30-inch telescope.
Yeah,
the
mirror is in the lobby of the new astronomy building on the campus. The dome is being used by the CU Astronomy Club down on the dark site south of the airport. The telescope itself was never terribly good. It was built by an amateur, and the mirror was poor at best.
But they had a 4-inch Ross Fecker astrogator.
Yeah, that was unfortunately stolen from us.
Stolen?
Yeah.
Someone stole a telescope?
Yeah, it was a 4-inch Ross camera that goes back into the 30s. It was used on the campus, and we had it down at the Perry Observatory, and someone broke in and stole the camera. We never got it back.
Oh, jeez.
Now, what they would do with it, I have no idea. It was not worth a lot on the secondary market. One of the things that I did that you can see from around here, if you go on out and look, are bright meteors. It's probably not worth in a bright sky standing outside waiting for one, but you'll occasionally see one unbidden zooming across the sky. People in Siberia saw a really big one, if you'll recall, in the daytime. It was about as bright as the sun as it was slamming through the Earth's atmosphere.
And that was the one that exploded above Chelyabinsk.
Yeah, I mean this. I mean, you talk about first magnitude, man. This is this overwhelms just about everything else in the sky. And I think most people have had have seen bright meteors at some time or other. They're a remarkable sight. And the little particles, after the thing explodes, a lot of them make it down to the ground and become what are called meteorites. Most of them, the vast majority, are asteroids that hit the Earth's stray out of the asteroid belt and hit the Earth's atmosphere.
So meteors are asteroids?
Most meteors are comet debris. The ones that make it to the ground are almost all for minority of meteors are asteroids, but most of it's comet debris that never makes it down to the ground. It's fluffy stuff that doesn't hit. Whereas most of the meteorites, the stuff that makes it to the ground, is from the asteroid belt. And one of the things I did want to mention in here in this show is that shortly after next week, you can go out to Starkel Planetarium, and we have a new meteorite exhibit out there. So you can not only get a good view of the sky, and Starkel is a great facility for around here, so I encourage everybody to go out and take a look. And you can see our new meteorite exhibit, the Goose Kaler Memorial Meteorite exhibit, which we have established out there.
Okay. Ed, I want to thank you very much for calling
in.
Thank you,
Ed.
And we were talking about meteors and asteroids. You have an asteroid named after you, don't you?
Yeah.
That's 17853 Kaler.
Yes, sir. It was a result of the outreach activities. Somebody thought it was worth naming one after me. And it's a big dumb rock out there in the main belt, and it doesn't come close. It's just benign. It just goes around the sun every 2-plus years, and is not one of those that is invasive of Earth, although it was probably discovered for during searches for nearby asteroids that do invade Earth.
How hard is it to see with a telescope?
Extremely difficult. It's very faint. I don't even know how bright it is. It's down around 18th magnitude or something like that. You need a large professional telescope to be able to see it.
But you know it's out there.
I know it's out there. And its orbit is well known, although it hasn't been viewed in several years.
Let's go back to another caller on line one, Rika in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering what Professor Kaler would recommend as, for a beginner, a telescope. For this area, you know, that we could see a little bit more than...
There are a lot of them available in mail order. The Mead Company, Celestron, you can get some good buys through the Orion Telescope Company. Just get on the web and put that in to Google. You don't want to start big. If you want to start a telescope, don't get anything bigger than a 3 or 4 inch reflector would work very nicely. But don't buy anything locally. The department store, mass market store telescopes aren't terribly good. You can see an awful lot with a small instrument, say a 3 or 4 inch mirror, starting with the moon, which is just a gorgeous sight. You can get maps of the moon available through the web, and you can just begin to identify features, and which are mostly impact craters from asteroids and ancient asteroids and comets all over the surface of the moon. Jupiter and Saturn show up very nicely. Venus, crescent of Venus, shows up well, and you can begin to see some clusters, and you get out in the dark sky some nebulae, the Orion Nebula. There's some beautiful sights available in small instruments. There's a question of taking the time to learn how to use it.
Okay, so that's a 3 to 4 inch.
Yeah, a good starter telescope might be a... Even a 60 millimeter refractor, which is the sort of the bottom line in beginners telescopes, I'd probably recommend a 4 inch reflector.
Okay.
Some assembly required. You got to put them together, follow the instructions, and they tend to be a little on the wobbly side. But for a couple $100, you can do fairly well.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Rika. About features that you can see.
If you got a few billion dollars available, then you put up another Hubble Space Telescope. And
then you can really see something.
You could really see something, yeah.
Now, is the Hubble the only telescope we have in space?
Far from it. Space is rich in astronomical telescopes. The Hubble is the only general purpose instrument that's up there where you can use both for imaging and for spectroscopy, where you break the light up into its component colors, which is one of the main functions of the thing. There are various cameras that can be swapped in and out of the field of view. One of the great advances of 20th century astronomy was the opening of the spectrum, where you don't get X-rays from space. You don't get ultraviolet light from space, which is a good thing. Otherwise, we'd all be fried by it. But that's because of the protective nature of the Earth's atmosphere. But if you put a satellite in orbit above the Earth's atmosphere, then you can see X-rays from space. You can see hard ultraviolet radiation, infrared radiation. The whole spectrum is available to you. And there are bunches of telescopes that have worked over the years to access the sky in various other wavelength bands.
How long are we going to have? I'm just looking it up on Wikipedia now and see that I do remember hearing some years ago about them having to repair the flaw that was present in the telescope.
Well, that was corrected very quickly. They effectively left the good mirror on the ground and sent the bad one up. For various reasons that are of historical interest only at this point. The point is that they sent up, but the astronauts installed new cameras with corrective lenses in it that corrected for the A-sphere, the mismaking of the mirror, and they produced absolute perfection. It's a gorgeous instrument that has been produced in amazing flow of results over the years that it's been up there.
It's how long can we have it?
I don't know. There's no way of repairing it anymore.
They've had some servicing missions.
They've had several servicing missions where they've put in new cameras, new controlling equipment and so on, new gyroscopes. But now it's when it finally expires, it'll be brought back to Earth. I think the astronauts put on retro rockets on the last one, and it will be brought down safely in the ocean,
okay,
where it can't hurt anybody. It will not be a museum piece. It cannot. There's no way of getting something up there to bring it back gently to Earth.
Now, I do see plans for another space telescope.
The James Webb Space Telescope used to be called the Next Generation Space Telescope, which has been subject of many cost overruns, and it's not clear that the thing is going to fly, although there's still plans to do so within the next half dozen years, perhaps.
Here it's saying around 2018.
Yeah.
Now, how many problems are involved here? I'm reading here that the mission was under review for cancellation by Congress a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was. And
but then they changed their minds.
They're going ahead with it. They've put a lot of money into it at this point. It's not going to be a serviceable telescope. It will be placed in a stable position in orbit around the sun, effectively. And when it dies, it dies. There's no way of bringing it back to life again, as we could with the Hubble. The match between the Hubble and the shuttle system was just remarkably good.
We have another caller on line one, Mitra in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I was just wondering if the professor had ever studied the Dogon or the Mithraic Mysteries. Both had astronomy very strongly in their
The Dogon, I believe, were the people who were supposed to have been able to see the companion to Sirius, which has been debunked, and there's no conceivable way they could have done that. There are lots of stories where occasionally ancient people have hit it right by accident, and this is probably one of them. It's like Jonathan Swift guessing the two moons of Mars before they were discovered. It's a pure speculation, and he happened to hit it right. He didn't see them, and the same is true for the Dogon people.
And the Mithraic, was that the other
phrase? I've read
yes,
it.
Mithraic Mysteries.
Yeah, I've forgotten most of what I read about that. There's lots of stories of ancient peoples doing sophisticated astronomy, and they did in their own way. And I think a lot of the legendary stuff takes away from the reality of what some of the ancients really did. Hipparchus, for example, has not only established the magnitude system, he discovered the precession of the Earth's axis, the wobble, 26,000-year wobble of the Earth's axis, all with the naked eye. A remarkable achievement. They were able to make estimates of the distance of the moon, the distance to the sun. They knew there were different distances, and all this came about from very sharp intelligence and naked eye observations.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling that in, Mitra.
Thank you.
And I don't know if nobody had a telescope back
then. Nobody had a telescope before 1609.
But I don't know what other tools might be useful in studying the heavens besides magnification.
Well, it's remarkable what the naked eye can do with some care. They were able to make the ancient Greeks were able to make maps of the sky, positional analysis, charting the motions of the planets against the background, even though they did not know what they were, came up with various schemes for predicting the positions of planets, which weren't terribly good, but were better than guesses. And as I say, measured the distance to the moon and the sun. Mm-hmm. The distance of the sun was terrible, but they at least knew it was farther away than the moon. The distance of the moon was pretty much right on the money.
Wow. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about urban stargazing for astronomer Jim Kaler or other astronomical questions.
Not only that, they knew the Earth was spherical and they knew the size of it. This goes back to 2,000 years.
Supposedly a lot of people did not know that stuff.
Well, it was tended to be forgotten over the years. Columbus certainly knew the Earth was a sphere. His crew might not have, but he did. They had messed up the size of it by then and thought it was smaller than it really was. But it's quite remarkable what came out of ancient times, which is the foundation, really, for modern astronomy.
Well, if you want to get a phone call in the Jim Kaler while in our remaining time, call us at 333-9455. Are toll free at 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. One caller just left a message for us reminding us that there's supposed to be a comet coming
yeah,
pretty well.
Yeah, Comet Pan-STARRS, a very strange name. It comes as a result of discovery by a telescope of the same name. And it's talked to Dave Leake at Starkle. He's seen it a couple of times over in the northwest just after sundown. You've got to have a clear horizon and a very clear sky and a very low horizon.
When is it coming?
It's here.
Oh, it's here. This one is
here
now.
Yeah, you can see it now. But it's not a major sight. It'll sweep up over the next couple of months past the Little Dipper in the northern sky. How bright it'll be, I don't know.
Our callers seem to think that something big was coming in November.
There's another comet called ISON, which is on its way, and we don't know how bright it's going to be. It's been predicted at times to be as bright as the moon. Anybody who makes a prediction about how bright comets are going to be should go to Las Vegas and play blackjack. Your chances are higher.
I remember back in the 1970s standing out on a winter's night looking for Comet
Kohoutek.
Which was disappointing as far as naked eye viewing was concerned.
Then we had Comet Hale-Bopp, which came around in the 90s, which was a beautiful sight. You couldn't miss it. It was gorgeous. Looking out in the northwest in the western sky, I could see it from my living room, for heaven's sakes. And so the things are terribly unpredictable. Comets are wet. The standard idea is a dirty snowball. They're dust and rocks mixed in a matrix of ice, and the ice sublimes away and melts away by sunlight and produces the tail. But you don't know the rate. You can't predict the rate at which the stuff comes off. So it's very difficult to predict the brightness of a comet.
Line one has Carol in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. We recently were in South Africa, and we took a trip up to Sutherland, which has the largest optical telescope in the Southern Hemisphere. And the sky up there is amazing.
It's something to see, isn't it?
Oh, it's high up in the mountains. No pollution. There are 3,000 people in Sutherland and nothing of any size around it.
Yeah, South Africa was a favorite haunt of the Northern Hemisphere astronomers who would go down there to observe. There are a number of historical observatories down there.
Yeah, they have a large sort of hostel for the people that are coming, and they said they are fully booked all the time, and many other countries have built smaller observatories
around the big one. You can get the same experience in the American Southwest, getting out into the desert, and it's a magnificent sight. The beauty of the Southern Hemisphere is that the way the Earth is oriented, the brightest parts of the Milky Way are in the Southern Hemisphere,
right,
and not terribly accessible from the North. You get into the Southern Hemisphere. South America and South Africa and below the equator, and the Milky Way from down there is spectacular. You don't have to look for it. You look up and
right.
You just...
It's there.
It's a jaw-dropping experience.
Yeah, well, we spent 3 hours one evening with one of the people who worked at the observatory just looking at things, and it was unbelievable.
It's beautiful. Gorgeous, gorgeous sight. You can see this band of darkness running right down the middle with all the dust in the middle of the Milky Way where the stars are born, and you can stand there for hours and just stare at it.
Well, if anyone gets to South Africa, it's certainly worth a trip.
Yeah. South America does just as well.
As
long as you get down into the deserts and the mountains, couple of tens of degrees south of the equator, you can see some magnificent sights.
Carol, thank you very much for calling in. Just feel like it's sort of a pauper's diet for watching stars in the city, but that is the subject of your book, making the best of a couple of dozen stars.
If your city's not too big, you can see the first magnitude ones. Buildings tend to get in the way of the lower ones, but in the summertime, and you can see Vega overhead. You can see some star colors. Take a close look at stars, and you can see that some of them are a little bit on the orange, yellow orange side, which are the ones that are in the process of dying. They've swollen up to become what are called giant stars, something the sun will do someday in the next several billion years. And you can begin to pick out some interesting features of these, even with the naked eye.
We had going to the opposite end of stargazing, I guess. We had a caller leaving a message asking, what is the current estimate of the numbers of galaxies in the universe?
Well, nobody knows, frankly. You have to restrict it to the number of observable galaxies, the ones that are observable with our telescopes. And if you take the observations of the Hubble Space Telescope, the very deep sky observations, the Hubble so-called Hubble Deep Field and the Ultra Deep Field, which is a very small field of view in which you can see thousands of galaxies and replicate that around the whole sky and ignore the obscuring effects of the dust in the Milky Way, potentially a trillion galaxies are observable.
That is mind-boggling.
Yeah, and when you consider those are basically the larger ones, not the little bitty dwarf ones, and that they contain hundreds of billions of stars apiece, you got a lot of stars.
And
the remarkable thing about all of this is when you add up the mass of all of these stars, it's only a percent of all the mass of the whole universe put together.
This comes into the whole dark matter mystery.
A whole dark matter where the dark matter overwhelms the bright matter of stars, and then you've got this dark energy business, which is causing an acceleration of the expanding universe, and you take the mass equivalent of that, and that overwhelms everything. It's about three-quarters of the whole mass energy content of the universe. And stars are a distinct minority of about 0.6% of the mass energy of the universe. But that doesn't reduce their importance, as a man who loves the stars wants to say, because they're tracers of everything that's out there. And without the stars, you don't know nothing, as they used to say.
I'd hope to get a phone call from the director of the Starco Planetarium, Dave Leake. I don't know if that's going to happen this hour.
No, I think he's doing he said he was doing a show.
But I think maybe you could tell us a little bit about the opportunities that the Planetarium presents.
Please get out to the Planetarium. It's a wonderful local facility. They have you can get on the web and see their show schedule. They have both live shows out there and professionally produced shows as well, which they run continuously. You can go out and see the new meteorite collection out there. We've got a 34-pound iron out there, which is really quite an awesome sight. It's about a foot long, and it's the sort of thing that you would not want to be hit with from the sky. And a variety of other ones. You can see with the sky, and go look at one of the nighttime shows in the dome, and you can see the sky the way it used to look in ancient times. And it is truly an awesome sight, and you can see what it is that we've lost.
I know they have regular shows on the weekends. Their website is at parkland.edu/planetarium. That's parkland.edu/planetarium. We just have about a minute left on Focus today with Jim Kaler. I want to take one more call from Stephen Champagne. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. So NASA, if I recall, recently published a montage of photographs of the Earth at night, and you could see the various cities and continents and that sort of thing lit up. And so my question is,
it's a picture on the back. It's on the back cover of the book.
How far away from the Earth would a telescope of Hubble's quality be able to see the Earth lit up? So the issue is, if there were aliens out there, how far would they have to be away?
In terms of optical light, I don't know. The Earth would fade out relative to the sun very, very quickly. You have to be pretty close to the Earth to see it lit up like that. And those are Earth-orbiting satellites that produced a panorama of the lit-up Earth, which is quite an awesome sight. But aliens, if such exist, and who knows, we're not talking about space aliens that have invaded Earth. We're talking about actual civilizations around other stars, would be able to, quote, see is our radio radiation from powerful transmitters that are escaping into space. We live in a bubble of radio radiation that is now about 100 light years in radius, and that incorporates a lot of stars. This from the first time the first commercial radio stations went on the air in the 1920s.
Fair enough. But I will say that the montage that that NASA published on the web was really spectacular.
Yes, it is, and it's also a sad thing in a way that because of the you can see how the Earth is lit up, and why people can't see the sky anymore.
Steve, thank you very much for calling. And the photo that Steve was talking about is on the back of your book, Jim Kaler, First Magnitude, A Book of the Bright Sky from World Scientific Publishing, about making the best of a light-polluted sky for stargazing. And Jim, I wanted to thank you very much for coming back to Focus to talk the new book, and hope to have you on again at some time.
Anytime. Thank you.